to be talking about these two recent papers. So here's an outline of what the talk is going to be about. And here on this board, I have written for you the Kerr metric in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. So what this metric describes is neutral rotating black holes. It's the kind of black holes that we see in the sky. Most of the things we see in the sky are neutral and rotating. So it's characterized by two parameters, the mass and the angular momentum J, which is AM. And by cosmic censorship, this angular momentum is bounded from above. And the equal is the extremal limit. So Kerr CFT is about this extremal Kerr black holes. So extremal Kerr black holes are rather special. One special thing that happens at extremality, so if A is equal to M, if you have an extremal Kerr black hole, then you have an infinite throat down to the black hole's horizon. And what that allows you is to effectively decouple the dynamics of the near horizon region from the far region. So in particular, the proper radial distance to the horizon is infinite. So, but what this allows me to do is to take the near horizon limit. So let me draw here the Penrose diagram for an extremal Kerr. So the Penrose diagram for an extremal Kerr looks like this. So this wiggly line is the singularity. These lines here are the horizons, the horizon, the extremal horizon, which is located at r hat is equal to m. And here you have future null infinity, past null infinity, so on and so forth. So what you can do in this case is, so constant r lines in this are like this. And what it means to take the near horizon region is, in this picture, to take the limit where you go close to this horizon. So if you go to a region like that, you can take this limit precisely, and that's going to give you what we call the near horizon extremal Kerr geometry. So if I draw here the global version of that geometry, it's going to look like this. So here, this is supposed to represent the shaded region, actually the global version of whatever metric you get when you take that near horizon limit. So you see there are two time-like boundaries, very much like ADS. The horizon that was here, you know, is inherited in here and is now located at r is equal to 0. So r is a new coordinate that I define to take this near horizon limit. So I define an r coordinate, which is r hat minus m, a dimensionless coordinate like that. So the scaling limit I need to take to get here is rather delicate. You need to do it correctly. And the correct way to do it is the following. So the hatted coordinates are the original Kerr coordinates, you know, the Boyer-Lindquist coordinates of Kerr. If I make this transformation and then I go to the small r limit, I am going to the near horizon region, but of course in a particular way. So one way to realize the scaling limit precisely is to introduce the scaling parameter lambda and take that lambda to 0. So if you do this, from extreme Kerr, you get to neck. So this we call neck for near horizon extremal Kerr. The neck geometry, the actual metric you get by doing all that, is the following. So here, this gamma of theta and lambda of theta are just some sines and cosines. And this is what we call the near horizon extremal Kerr metric. So first of all, you can see already that this is a lot simpler than the Kerr metric I had there before. Then you notice here it has a lot of ADS structure. This part by itself is, for example, ADS2. If this was a constant and you disregard this zeta squared, that would be, depending what the constant is, it would be either exact ADS3 or warped ADS3. So that's nice. What's more about this, of course, is that it has an enhanced symmetry group. So the Kerr metric had only two Killing vectors. There were d phi hat and dt hat. This has a lot more. This has an entire SL to R cross U1. So the d phi is here. The dt is here. But here there is more, of course. There's an entire SL to R in here. And so what the original, the way Kerr CFT was conjectured originally was by doing an asymptotic symmetry group analysis on this geometry and seeing that you can enhance, for example, this U1 to a full Virasoro, a left Virasoro with a central charge. So you do so here you do an asymptotic symmetry group analysis such that you remain extremal, for example. Then you get this one left Virasoro with a central charge which you can compute and is equal to 12J. So if you couple then that to the Frolov-Thorn temperature of the black hole, you will get that the Cardy formula, Cardy, pi squared over 3, gives you the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole as obtained by the area formula. So that was what originally motivated the Kerr CFT conjecture. And so the conjecture is that quantum gravity in the near horizon of an extreme Kerr is dual to a 2D CFT. So the story is that you can actually enhance this one to a Virasoro as well, depending on the boundary conditions you get. You can also have a current algebra. I'm not going to go into the details of all this, but the conjecture is that the near horizon, the quantum gravity in the near horizon region of an extremal Kerr is dual to a 2D CFT. And what that means in particular is that any process that takes place in that region should in principle be possible to compute in the dual CFT as well. One thing that has been done, for example, is the so-called superradiant scattering. So superradiant scattering has been computed and understood from the CFT point of view as well. What I will do today, is there a question?
Yeah.
Right. So in this unit, let's see, there is a rescaled, I mean, this is dimensionless. I mean, this should be rescaled by some H bars and right, and the G and all this. Right. The temperature is dimensionless, yeah. Sorry?
Are you
using point masses to make dimensions? Yeah. So as I said, you know, superradiance has been understood in this way. And what we did in these papers is we understood, first we did a computation that people did not know how to do on the gravity side. I should say, in these papers, there are two parallel stories. There is a gravity computation, and then there's a CFT computation. If you're a gravity person, you can follow entirely the gravity computation, ignoring completely the CFT sections of the papers. If you want to read the CFT sections, you can do that. You can follow that independently as well. And you will see the matching. So it's not like we compute something on one side and conjecture on the other side. We actually compute on both sides and we see that they match. So in that sense, we confirm the Kerr CFT conjecture as well. So what I will discuss is a process of gravity wave generation by a star or a small object orbiting near the horizon of such an extreme Kerr black hole. Actually, for simplicity, I will only discuss the scalar case. But you can find the gravity case in the papers. So if you're familiar with the Tucholsky papers, you know that whenever I will be using a scalar field, you can replace that by the appropriate Weyl scalar. If you don't know what that means, you should be comforted by the fact that there is conceptually no difference for discussing the scalar case versus the gravitational wave case.
So you're doing super reproducibility,
no,
not including gravitational vector action?
No, that's not what I'm doing. I'm doing gravity wave generation by point source orbiting near the horizon.
So I
should say a few words about the motivation. There are two motivations. There were two motivations, for example, for me. One is to theoretically test the Kerr-Sifty correspondence, which, as I said, do a computation and see that there is a correspondence, that there is a duality which works. And then the other is, of course, astrophysical relevance. These kind of situations arise in astrophysics, or people expect this extreme mass ratio in spirals, which are important sources of gravitational waves that LISA could observe, for example. There are extremal black holes in the sky, both stellar mass and supermassive. And so, for example, if you are in this MCG 630-15, that's a supermassive black hole at the center of a galaxy, has an accretion disk, and LISA, for example, can expect an event rate of a lot of this extreme mass ratio in spirals. These things generate gravitational waves that LISA could potentially observe. Now, what happens usually is that you have a huge black hole, and then you have a small black hole or a star orbiting around it in nearly circular orbits for a very long time. So roughly a year it spends in quasi-circular orbit, so the orbit shrinks slowly as it radiates. And then when it hits the so-called innermost stable circular orbit, that's when it quickly plunges into the black hole. So there is a phase where it's circular orbits around it, and then there's a phase where it plunges, so the plunge phase. So the first paper discusses the circular case. The second paper discusses the plunge.
What role does the ergosphere play in the disruption?
The atmosphere?
The ergosphere.
The ergosphere. All this is deep down the ergosphere.
Oh, you're inside the...
Yes, this near horizon region is... we're really near the horizon. There's an infinite throw. This is all deep down the ergosphere.
And he says the neck region is really just outside the horizon, whereas the ISCO is much further out, to a 3M or whatever. So, in a sense, are we just going to get the gravity waves from the part where it plunges right through the near horizon region rather than the spiral phase, which is presumably far outside the neck region?
Right. So remember, in the extremal case, the ISCO, first of all, the coordinate of the ISCO degenerates with the horizon. And the ISCO for the extremal or near extremal care is also deep down the throat. It's also where the CFT is operating. So all of the process is taking place there. So far, what people do to compute these things is because they think they are in care, and so that's the only thing you can do, is they either use post-Newtonian approximation, which is clearly not good because we are in the strong gravity regime near the horizon of this black hole. Or they do numerics, which they can be very impressive, but of course, as you also know, are limited. Now, we can do these things analytically because we know that there is this extra CFT symmetry, so we can compute things that people didn't expect to be able to compute. So what's the plan? The plan, as I said, we're now done with this. So the plan is to couple a scalar field to the point particle. As I said, this is just a model, it's conceptual. In the sky, what will happen is it will generate gravitational waves. But conceptually, the problem is exactly the same. So I will couple the point source to a scalar field and compute the gravitational waves generated by this source in gravity. Then I will move on and consider the same process in the CFT. I will show that putting that source induces a transition rate in the state of the CFT, and the rate of transition is going to match the particle number of flux in gravity. And then in the last section, I will go away from extremality. We'll go to a near extremal Kerr black hole, and we'll consider that Planck phase. Okay, so let me give the let me first sort of give the messages without even starting to write equations yet. So the message is that in NEC there are no stable there's no innermost stable circular orbit because orbits at any radius are marginally stable. The wave equation in NEC can be solved in terms of Whittaker functions analytically. And you know, from that solution, we can compute, for example, the Klein-Gordon particle number flux down the horizon. In the CFT, putting that source corresponds to deforming the CFT at appropriate scales. And the result of that is that there will be a transition rate out of the vacuum. And we can compute using Fermi's golden rule that transition rate. And we'll see that the two match. For the Planck problem in here, for the Planck problem, we'll move to what I call near neck, which is another metric very similar to this one, where, again, there is no ISCO in the sense that the innermost stable circular orbit is away at infinity. So that's why everything plunges in near neck. But it turns out that this Planck trajectory, which is rather complicated, it's not like a circle in NEC, is related by a conformal map to the circular problem. So once we solve the circular problem, the Planck problem will be an easy transformation. Okay, so let's dive in. Are there any questions before I begin? Okay, so let's dive in. So as I said, there's no ISCO in NEC. You have instead stable circular, marginally stable circular orbits at every radius. So an equatorial geodesic is given by, if I parameterize it by time t, is given by 5.0 3/4 t. And theta is pi over 2. I'm only considering equatorial orbits. So this is my orbit. It has energy 0 and angular momentum 2m over square root of 3. This is with respect to the Killing vectors of the neck metric. So this there is a very simple geodesic. It's a circular geodesic in neck. So I couple it to a scalar field via an interaction term like that. So lambda is a coupling constant. I have a scalar field, like I'm calling it psi. I have the particle's geodesic here, and tau is the proper time. I couple it, so I couple my scalar field with an interaction term like that, and therefore I get a wave equation, which is, which looks like this. So here. This operator is with the neck metric, right? So the nice thing about this orbit is that it has a manifest Killing symmetry with respect to this vector. So this is a Killing symmetry of both my orbit and, of course, my metric. So I can use it to simplify my life and actually solve this equation. Do So the chi-invariant expansion is going to look like that. So these functions here, they obey a differential equation, which is well known. It's some differential equation. They are called spheroidal harmonics, and they obey a differential equation of this form, which is well known to. So this is an eigenvalue regularity on. So there's a complete set of solutions. There's a complete set of functions here which are regular on 0 pi. And regularity at the ends of this interval restricts the spectrum to a discrete one. So you have a discrete set of functions with these eigenvalues, and they are complete on this interval. So basically, that's what allows you to affect this expansion here using this function. So once you do that, all you're left with is basically a radial equation for this to solve, right? OK. So let me write out that radial equation. Let me write the radial equation. If I write here, can people see? When people say nothing, that probably means some of them don't see, but they don't want to say so. So let's write the radial equation. The radial equation. So where was it? So I had that expansion, so I'm writing an equation for this RLM now, right? The radial equation is like that. Now, so far, the process is exactly what you would do in CARE, for example. But the main difference is that because this is the neck wave equation, this equation can actually be solved. It's unlike the CARE equation in that we know its solutions. So, and the source I will have here is given by this lambda 2m, this function at pi over 2, r0 delta r minus r0. And this omega is just minus 3/4 R0 M. So unlike the CARE equation, this can be solved. There are two singularities, one regular, one irregular, here. And the solutions to the homogeneous problem corresponding to this equation are known. There are the Schumer functions, Tricomi functions, Whittaker functions. All these are basically confluent hypergeometric functions, you know, one step below the hypergeometric function in the ladder. It's where you take the three singularities, two of the three singularities of the hypergeometric equation, you merge them, and you make one irregular singularity. So
I mean, of course, you couldn't solve it exactly, but I mean, there should still be some sort of decent approximation. I mean, we use WKV plus that turning point.
Yeah, you can do all sorts of approximations. People are doing this. You know, there are people who have careers in solving, you know, this kind of equation. I mean, but nobody can solve them exactly in closed form.
No,
that's what you want to do. You can do it, and people do it. Yes. But in NEC, because of this enhanced symmetry, basically because of the presence of this SL2R, that equation is a well-known equation with a closed-form solution that you can give to Mathematica, and they can spit you, you know, can spit you the value at any point at precisely. So let me say what the boundary conditions will be that I'm going to impose. So remember, this was the picture. So this is the horizon. This orbit is here, so this is the R0. So what the solutions to the homogeneous problem behave, you know, have two behaviors. At R is equal to zero, they can either behave like this, or like that. So this is representing ingoing waves at the future horizon here, and that's what I'm going to choose for one of my boundary conditions. So this guy. And at infinity, you can have two behaviors. Where H is defined as H is this. So this we call this one we call the Dirichlet mode, and this one we call the Neumann mode. By the way, the reason we call this H is because that's going to be the weight of the dual operator, and you can see it, you can see it from basically from this power law behavior that H is going to be the weight. So here we impose Neumann boundary conditions. If we want to isolate this neck from the rest, and we want to do a problem that we will be able to understand only within neck, and therefore from the corresponding CFT, we pick the Neumann boundary condition, and that basically means that stuff is reflecting off this boundary and falling back into the horizon. So with these boundary conditions, the solution. Right. If you want to get the signal at flat infinity, then yes, you need to modify this boundary condition I'm putting in at the boundary of neck here to allow radiation to flow through that.
Work in progress.
Huh?
That's sort of work in progress, is it?
No, that's part of these papers. Yeah. It's just probably I won't have enough time to cover that. The way you do this is rather standard. You use this so-called method of matched asymptotic expansions. And that's how you glue back the flat region here. You can find that in the papers. If I have time, I might mention this as well. So the solutions that behave like this are two Whittaker functions. So that means I need to pick something that will behave like the W Whittaker function near the horizon, and this. Means that the solution should behave like the M with the Whittaker function at the horizon. So the problem to the full, so basically, we're looking here for the Green's function, right? We have a delta function source on the right-hand side, so we're basically looking for the Green's function. With these boundary conditions, the solution looks something like this. Some coefficient here, step function. Let me write. Now there's a Whittaker function here, plus some other coefficient. And another Whittaker function. Again, these functions are well-known functions. So the way you fix, of course, these coefficients is by continuity at R0 and by having the right jump as given by this coefficient here. Okay, so X and Z are known constants. So once you have the solution, once you have the full solution, you can in principle compute whatever you want. What we wanted to compute to match with the CFT is the Klein-Gordon current. There's a Klein-Gordon current, which is basically something like this. From that, you can compute the particle number flux across the horizon. So the rate of inflow of particles to the horizon. Let me just write the answer to that so that we can appreciate it. I'm only considering the real edge case for today. And then here is the that Whitaker function at so here's the Klein-Gordon particle number flux. So again, this is the number of particles per unit time that flow into the horizon here. Okay. And this is this is basically the end of this. Okay. Now let's move to the CFT. So what happens, what's the dual situation in the CFT? So we've put in a source in the bulk, and what that corresponds to is a deformation in my CFT at appropriate scales. So by the so-called scale radius duality, putting in a source at this radius R0 means deforming my CFT at scales R less than R0. So let's write some formulas. What do I mean by deforming my CFT? What I mean is that I have my action is my original CFT action. Deformed by a source term like this. So t plus t minus are the left right moving coordinates on my CFT. By identifying the bulk isometries, dt, d phi of this with translations in my CFT, I can choose up to a scale t plus to be phi, t minus to be t. And then by chi invariance, I of course will expand that JL. Like this. So if I know these guys, I know exactly the deformation of my CFT. Oh, I should say, of course, there's a similar expansion for this OL, and these modes are the dual to my bulk mode solution over there, with left and right weights HR and H left equal to H. So I need to determine this JLM, that source there. So the way I do this is, as I said, that source in the bulk. So if I had no source, if I was doing ADS-CFT, for example, vacuum situation, sources in the CFT are determined by the Dirichlet mode of your bulk field, right? But remember, I chose a solution which had no Dirichlet modes; it was only Neumann. But I'm also not in vacuum. I have this star sitting at that finite radius in the bulk. What that corresponds to is a deformation of the CFT at scales R less than R0. So to determine the source, what I need to do is I need to take this solution I have here and extend it all the way to the, and take the solution I have for R less than R0, this, and extend it all the way to the boundary. So basically I erase this and I consider this solution here. Now that solution will have, I'm imposing Neumann boundary conditions at infinity here. So I said no. The solution I had here, RLM, was going to have only Neumann modes at the boundary of neck. Now I'm saying that in order to get the source, the correct deformation of the CFT, I need to consider not that solution, but the extension of the R less than R0 solution all the way to the boundary. And that will have both Neumann and Dirichlet modes at the boundary.
Totally.
The boundary is still R is equal to infinity. So let me write it here. So So this guy, when I take R to infinity, will behave like this. It will be, so basically, as I said, I extend it all the way, so no, this is not there either. So this is R extended. And this at infinity will behave like that. Some factor which I care very much is the Dirichlet mode. And then you know, another mode, the Neumann mode, which I, for determining the source, I don't care about. See, if I had my solution to the bulk problem with the source in there, there was no Dirichlet mode because I imposed Neumann boundary conditions. There was only this mode. Now, for determining the source that sits in here in deforming the CFT, I consider this solution, and I take its Neumann, its Dirichlet mode at the boundary, and I call that the source. So this piece here is JLM. Yeah.
But now you're adding in the deformation, and then that does produce a Dirichlet
mode. No, the other way around. So in the first section, I was solving the gravity problem with the source in at R0. I was solving it with a certain set of boundary conditions. The boundary conditions I chose was ingoing radiation at the future horizon and Neumann at the boundary. So therefore, my solution, I was going to pick the solution I found at R goes to infinity behaved like this. There was no Dirichlet mode. It was only this Neumann mode. And at the horizon, of course, was this. Now, what I'm saying is that, so this is the solution to the bulk problem, to the gravity problem. Now the question becomes, what is the deformed CFT? Basically, what is this source here that corresponds to my situation over there? In regular radial CFT with no bulk sources, that would be the solution to the wave equation, take it to the boundary, rid off the Dirichlet mode. But as I said, in our case, there's no Dirichlet mode. And that is because the prescription is not correct. What I said before, what I just said, is not what happens when you have bulk sources. When you have bulk sources, in particular here, you have one at R is equal to R0. The CFT is deformed at scales, at corresponding scales. It scales R less than R0. So there's a so-called scale radius duality where, you know, depending on how deep you are in the bulk, you deform the CFT at appropriate scales. For example, in ADS5, you can put a D3 brain somewhere, and keeping boundary conditions, you have a UN theory and the UN minus one theory on the other side.
So we're saying just the source switches off in the UV, but it's not there in the IR, we're saying the source switches off in the UV, but it's not there in the IR, is it sort of wrapping up?
We're more saying here what the dual CFT is. What the deformed CFT is that corresponds to this picture here. And what I'm saying is that it has this action here, where the source is read off from the R less than R0 part of my solution to the full problem here. So this solution here. Okay? So once I know that, I know everything. I now know precisely the deformation, and so I can compute the transition that this induces. So having that deformation there in the CFT induces transitions out of the vacuum. And the transition rate can be computed using Fermi's golden rule. So if you use Fermi's golden rule, that deformation implies the transition rate in the CFT. Which is given by basically it's given by the Fourier transform of the two-point function of the CFT. Okay, so now this is the quantum we want to compute. This two-point function is universal in any CFT. So I don't need to know precisely what the CFT is, whether it's composed of bosons, fermions, scalars, or whatever. This has a universal form, which is which is well known, and so you can compute this Fourier integral. So if you do that, up to a normalization of the operators, you will get this expression. So this CO is a normalization of the operator. It only depends on the weight of the operator. So if I pick that normalization appropriately, and that means in this case 2h minus 1. So if I pick the correct normalization, and I plug in here that boxed expression in here, and compute that transition rate, I will get that this RCFT is precisely equal to my Klein-Gordon particle number flux across the horizon. So you see all this long expression here, down to every detail, every factor of m, every power of m, every gamma function is reproduced by this CFT transition rate with the source identified, as I explained. Okay, see how much time we have. So here's a matching of a bulk computation, the particle number flux flowing down the horizon, to a boundary CFT computation, the transition rate in the CFT. Yes? This m?
Yeah,
that's the Whittaker function. Yeah.
It's the same m as
here? Which m here?
In CO.
This m? Oh, no, sorry. This is the mass of the black hole. This is the constant. Isn't that fine? This CO is a normalization of the operators. It's something that's a constant, only can only depend on the weight. Okay. So we're done with that too. Are there any questions?
So essentially, if the partial wave corresponds to a different source, a different operating CFT, which is a source of computing scattering from, say, one of these partial waves, and then with some of all the other partial waves produced using Fermi's golden rule. I'm just trying to understand out loud.
Right.
Yeah, so it's going to have a sum of all the states we're scattering into, which all the that's your sum over Lm, and each partial wave, each individual Lm corresponds to an individual source in the CFT.
Right. Yeah. So the waves are each mode, each Lm mode of my bulk field sources an OLM field. So there's no scattering here. So OL. I should say, this L index comes basically from a Kaluza-Klein reduction along the theta direction. So, that's why you have the sum over L over there. And then you obviously expand this OL just like the source J. So, that adds the M index. So then you have this OLM e to the minus I T plus. And so every mode of my bulk solution, every LM mode of my bulk solution corresponds to sourcing an operator OLM in the CFT. And the source JLM is, you know, is as I explained, you know, obtained from here. Okay. All right. So are there any more questions? All right. So now let's say a few words about what happens for this problem. Lambda, I mean the coupling constant? Yeah. Oh, it is there. So it's in X. Remember these coefficients here were constants that were determined by the coefficient of the delta function in my Green's equation. Now that coefficient, you know, had this lambda, had this factor here. Now this is where they come from. They are in X. I didn't write explicitly out what X is equal to. I can if you want. But you know, it's basically, you know, that prefactor of the delta function. All right. So okay. So let's move on now to the Planck problem. So this was the circular problem in NEC. Now, if I have a nearly extremal Kerr black hole, and I go near very near the horizon, I get what's called the near neck metric. So if I go near the horizon but not too close to the horizon, I still get the neck metric. You know, I'm looking at basically an extremal Kerr black hole. But if I have a nearly extremal Kerr, and I define this kappa, which is, you know, this parameter. So if I have a nearly extremal Kerr, this is very small, I can go very near the horizon of the black hole and get the so-called near neck metric. So the near neck metric is rather similar to the neck metric, except that here you have what's called the near neck metric. And in this metric, so now this is dual to a CFT with both left and right temperatures. So the left is, you know, well, what used to be there for neck as well. And now there's a right moving temperature which is given by this. And for the near neck metric, there is again no innermost stable circular orbit. But unlike the neck, in the sense that the innermost stable circular orbit is at infinity. So now in near neck, again, no ISCO in near neck. Well, let's say ISCO in near neck. Is at r is equal to infinity. Okay? So it has energy, it has the same energy and angular momentum as the previous one. So if I solve the geodesic equations in near neck, you know, for these constants, I get the following orbit. So the orbit now is again, at the equatorial plane, of course. So now this is the orbit that has the parameters of the A squared infinity, and it's an orbit that plunges into the horizon. So it falls into R tilde is equal to zero as T tilde goes to infinity. So now this is the plunge. And it's a complicated enough orbit that I wouldn't be able to do what I did for the circular orbit. It would be very hard for me to plug that into a source term in the wave equation on the right-hand side and solve it. And basically, I wouldn't be able to do the integral, right? But here's the magic of the CFT. This orbit is actually related by conformal transformation to the circular orbit I had in NEC. So let me draw this into this picture. So in this picture, this big wedge here is the neck patch. So this entire thing is the global version of neck. This here is neck, the Poincaré patch, is what I had before, without the kappas basically in there. And the near neck geometry can also be put in this picture. It's a smaller patch. It's this small patch here. So what that means is that there is a diffeomorphism. There's a coordinate transformation I can make to go from this metric to the neck metric. And that coordinate transformation is the following. So there's a bulk diffeomorphism which is going to take me. So the bulk diffeomorphism, so T is now the coordinate of the neck metric I had before. Should I write the neck metric? You understand, right? The neck metric is, so this is near neck, and then there is neck. Now this is near neck. The neck metric is basically exactly like this, except that here I had this, right? And then here I also had, it's like setting kappa to zero. So here I just had d phi plus r dt. So the bulk diffeomorphism that I can do to get from neck to near neck is the following. So if I do this transformation, that will take me from neck to near neck. And moreover, it will take this orbit here, so the plunge, to the circle I had before. Now the parameters are related like that. So just to reiterate, if I make this bulk diffeomorphism, I will I will move from neck to near neck, and I will map my circular orbit that I had before, r is equal to r0, to this complicated plunge orbit here. So in the gravity, if I want to compute the gravitational waves there, for example, the solution of the wave equation there, all I have to do is to affect this diffeomorphism. Right, it's a coordinate change, but it's more than a coordinate change. Yes, it's singular here at the boundary. This picture actually shows it very well. So this small wedge here is near neck, this large wedge is neck, and the same orbit, that was this circle in neck, is actually plunging into the future horizon of near neck. So here's the future horizon of near neck. This is the R tilde equals to zero line. So that same orbit is seen to plunge into the future horizon of near neck. So I can affect this bulk diffeomorphism and get the solution to the complicated plunge problem in near neck by simply this transformation. Equivalently, what I can do is I can also do the same thing in the CFT. So if I take this diffeomorphism to the boundary, that corresponds to a transformation in the CFT, which is this. Well, that doesn't change. So no, this is the boundary. The boundary conformal transformation. So I can also do this conformal transformation in my CFT. And what happens is that basically this relation persists. So the gravity is equal to the transition rate in the CFT. I mean, I can do this independently on the CFT side and see how my transition rate is expressed in, after this conformal transformation on the boundary. Basically, I know the weights of the operators, I know the weight of the source, the conformal invariance of the perturbation term, and therefore I can transform everything. If I do that, I get an RCFT in near neck, and if I do this on my near neck bulk solution, I can compute again the Klein-Gordon particle number flux and obtain this quantity. And this remains valid in the limit when kappa is much less than one. Okay, that's basically the end of that too. So I can answer some more questions, or if you want, I can say a few words about how you do the matching to flat infinity, if you wish. It's entirely up to you. Yes?
Does anything interesting happen if you're not in South Pole? This analysis of being a plane, which is reasonable for treating this.
My recollection is that the atmosphere touches the effective line in North and South Poles.
Yeah.
So something interesting might happen there.
Well, certainly we didn't consider non-equatorial orbits. That is, just for simplicity, we didn't consider non-equatorial orbits.
In another visual context, it might be used
for jets. For jets, yes, exactly. There are jets that come out of the poles. Yes, the message is that anything that happens in the near horizon region of an extreme care should be possible to understand from the CFT point of view, because the CFT symmetry of Kerr CFT is derived basically from diffeomorphisms of general relativity, so the asymptotic symmetry group analysis there. It's not an approach where it's not a duality where we know what the precise CFT is. It's not like that. It follows merely from diffeomorphism symmetries of GR. So anything that takes place in the near horizon region of an extreme Kerr should in principle be possible to understand in this CFT language as well. Yes, yeah, so jets or any, you tell me what the interesting phenomena you're interested in are, and it should be an interesting problem for Kerr CFT as well.
I mean, you have this instability in the horizon.
Mm-hmm. And certainly when we get to near equivalent, at least a lot of us think, certainly in that limit, you're going to get a strong curvature singularity there. This is where you're taking into account that graduation. You don't seem to be doing near.
So is that a question?
Yeah, so I mean, is that really going to, you really think that's going to be, well, do you think that's going to be a CFT? And
what is going to be
it? Once you take into account the instability of the inner horizon gravitational back reaction?
So the CFT operates in the region near the outside, near the outer horizon. So the instability of the near horizon is not something that I am, I can say anything about.
Well, certainly in the limit they approach each other.
Okay.
There's a strong expectation that they get very large curvatures.
Yes. But, so basically, is your question about whether extremal Kerr black holes exist or not? Is this what
you're... it's just a question of how far, maybe
you're slightly overly bold, or maybe we'll depend on the statement about the, everything we could possibly see would be reproduced in the CFT.
The conjecture is that anything that takes place outside, near the horizon, near the horizon of a nearly extremal Kerr black hole is governed by an infinite dimensional conformal symmetry. That's the statement. And therefore, all processes that take place there should be possible in principle to understand from the CFT point of view. That's what I'm not saying that, any particular problem should be understood in its own way. Of course, this is one problem that we understood.
What you said earlier, which was just that if you want to include back reaction, just get the Tsiolkovsky equation and replace the scalar field here with psi minus 2. I was just this point you made earlier, you could sort of have a back reacting case in minimized perturbation theory, just replace the scalar field with psi.
That wasn't including back reaction. That was only still linear generation of gravitational waves. Right, you can. In the sky, maybe I didn't make it clear. In the sky, there are probably no scalar fields lying around Kerr black holes, so stars orbiting around these black holes won't source scalar fields, but they will source gravitational waves. And you do exactly what I did today with the Tucholsky scalar. Yeah, you can find that in the paper. Just for simplicity, I was talking about the Klein-Gordon field. Any more questions? Yes, we are already over time.
Can you say anything to the next order in K?
Can I say anything next order in K? I guess not.
Because you made the symmetries.
Yeah, I mean.
What I was after was, if you take the conjecture as true, where you calculate one of them outside the beyond the first order in K, would inform you about what you could be doing on the other side.
You could do this. It's just it's going to be messy. You just use second order perturbation
on the Darby side.
On both sides.
On both sides.
Yeah. It would just be much ugly.
Well, I mean, in principle, yes, there is some. you go away from the conformal point probably, so it's definitely not an easy question to answer. Yeah, I don't see any obstruction in principle, but in practice, I don't think that's something we can do now.
Sort of a similar problem, much, much simpler case, something like the cosmology version of the problem, you can do the second order in conformal perturbation theory. This is a harder problem, of course, but in principle, I think you could do it.
Right, you can try to do the gravity computation, but you have to do it in certain approximations. And the fact that this is an analytic solution can actually help you very much, that at first order you know the solution exactly. That I guess, yes, there are techniques to do. But I was thinking more of understanding, how you move away from the CFT, in what sense, and what that maps to in that case. I don't have an answer to that question.
Thank you.